Thanks, Kate. Appreciate it. It's good to see all of you. Thanks, Bob, for that meditation. It's probably going to be better than my talk, really, to tell you the truth. Along the same lines, though. So as you know, we've been in a series around the great questions, and I wanted to wrestle with this particular question: is the universe friendly? That's Einstein's question. He doesn't really answer it. Otherwise, I could just tell you what he said, and then we could kind of be done with it. But he sort of is emerging up out of this landscape of math and science and the deep mysteries of the universe, to which we're only now sort of coming into more consciousness around. And that's his question coming up out of this world: is the universe friendly or not? And so at the very least, I would like to suggest that this is a worthwhile question. And what we know about the world, the universe, what may traditionally be called cosmology, how the world came into being and how it works, the process by which it exists, is a vast and wild and changing field at the present. And we're like way behind. Well, you might not be. I'm way behind. I'm way behind the most recent windows into how the universe works. And there seems to be a relationship between what we know about the world and how we live. And so I'm not just sort of, that's what makes the kind of mystery of this question interesting to me. Is the universe friendly? Like, what kind of word is friendly, you know? And if it's not friendly, how do we live? Or if it is friendly, how do we live? Or if we can't decide if it's friendly or not, how do we live? The realm of ethics and morality and justice and human culture is directly related to how the world actually works. We know that just on a scientific level. We are part of the universe. We're not separate from it. So you have that as a fact. But also, how we conceive of things changes our behavior. And we have a lot of catching up to do. And it also seems like, on one level, this is a fight we're going to lose, because the exponential growth of scientific insight and technology, who can keep up with it at this point? Maybe you saw those pictures from the latest telescope. Is that telescope? Is that the right word for it? I think, whatever. A thing that goes, you know, binoculars, all right? Glasses, intense glasses for human beings. I don't even know what to do with an image like that, really. Like, what is this place? You know, what is this place? And that does affect how we live, and it affects the kinds of conclusions we draw about what's valuable in life. And so those are I'm just dancing around the question today. I'm not going to really answer it so much, big surprise. But I'm just going to play with it a little bit and see what unfolds. But speaking of being friendly, a little housekeeping, all right? So we're now a month into sharing this space with our neighbors, Life Church. And by and large, my view of Ken Dobson, it's going very well. I mean, I was nervous. I don't know if you were nervous, but I was nervous. How do we share a space? They have two services every week. They have a community. They've got kids around. How is this going to work? Because the community center felt like our space. You know, we've been here for a long time, and by and large, it's gone well. And we had a meeting last week. And as new relationships go, we're getting to the stage where small things are annoying us. You know how it is when you first start dating. At first, it's awesome, and then you're like, after even like a week, you're like, well, actually, I'm kind of annoyed by fill in the blanks. So we're at that stage. And so we had a real honest conversation about, like, what are the petty things that are annoying us? Like, we had a few petty things. That's the word I actually used, and we used together. And I expressed some things, expressed some things, and they expressed some things. And this is a really important part of having a healthy and welcoming relationship. So we're trying to work through those things. What I want to ask you to do is be as kind as possible, really. I mean, one of our values is inclusivity, and they always haven't felt that welcome by certain individuals here. And maybe it's felt the other way around too, but we want to try to be as inclusive and as welcoming as we can to our neighbors. So that's the ongoing and pressing really challenge for us. So, and a couple practical things. The coffee, you're more than welcome to purchase the coffee. That's their coffee. They make it, they sell it, and they just recoup the costs. But that's theirs. Of course, we have our free coffee over here. But anyway, if you want a latte or whatever, that's sure. Stand in line, and you're more than welcome to that. They're totally fine with that. We are trying to share the hallway space. It is technically neutral space, though they don't have a place where they can really stand around. Like, we can stand around in here. You can't really stand around in the theater seats because they're tiered. So, but technically, the hallway is a place that's shared, and we're at the stage where if you don't know someone over there, you're going to keep seeing them, so you might as well get to know them. Like, I mean names, you know, get to know their names. You're going to see them each week. Like, I saw a kid today, and he said, "Nice shoes." I don't look at them now. Anyway, I said, "Your shoes are terrible," and kept walking. Anyway, so I'm just encouraging you to be gracious and inclusive, and we try to work through. If you do have any questions or concerns, you can come to me or any of the other leadership, and we'll talk about it. We actually have a sort of a liaison or liaisons between their community and our community, so we can just work this stuff out on a kind of one-to-one basis without involving the community center. So anyway, that's just a little housekeeping detail I wanted to start with. Okay. Okay, I'm going to start with reading a passage here from Bertrand Russell. It's written a few years ago, so you know, the gendered language is quite obvious here. But that man is the product of causes which has no prevision of the end they were achieving. Okay, so human beings are the product of causes which had no prevision of the end that they were achieving, that his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves, his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collections of atoms. You with me so far? Like songs and beauty and art and aims and purpose and meaning. Accidental collection of atoms. That no fire, no heroes, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual beyond the grave. That all the laborers of all the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system. I know, I'm starting to laugh now. Are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. What an interesting statement. He's sort of saying, if the universe doesn't collapse unto itself in a solar, or that he's saying that the universe will collapse unto itself in a solar death, and that no philosophy that doesn't take that into consideration is worth anything. Okay? So he's saying, face the facts. It might be true that love is the only thing being alive for, but we're also going to burn out in a solar death. Okay? Good morning. Glad you joined us. Now, here's where he brings in a bit of the existential undertones. Because this is not a fun fact to face. Wouldn't it be better if the earth was only 5,000 years old and you're going to die and go to heaven and that's just it? You know, wouldn't that be great? Okay. He says, only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the first foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. He's the precursor to the existential philosophers like Nietzsche. And he's saying, this is hard. This is hard. This is hard truth. And it's actually a kind of despair, kind of despair is present in here. And I think Einstein is actually in conversation with this. When he's saying, is the universe friendly, it's not like a, like, I don't know, some chipper thought, you know? Like, yes, it is. He's has looked into the vast reaches of space, of solar death, and black holes, and wrinkles in time, and things like this. And these are, and a scaffolding is being built here. And the question is, does that lead us to despair or not? It certainly is challenging, wouldn't you agree? It's challenging, because you could say, like, let's take some of the things that you might care about, and we'll now bring it just for a second into the moral and ethical realm. Well, what about problems on the earth right now? Things that seem wrong that can be righted, or things like racism, or homophobia, or climate catastrophes or disasters, or do you know the number one danger? It depends on who you ask to the future of human beings is nuclear war. That seems to be the number one. Climate change is actually quite far ways down, depending on who you consult for these things. Why? Because we have enough nuclear weapons to annihilate everyone and just about everything in a untimely solar death. So, okay, again, sorry for that. But you could just say, what does it matter? What does it matter? Really, it's just a random collection or collision of atoms and particles. There's no meaning, there's no purpose, there's no responsibility. It's just, I guess we're lucky or unlucky. That's just depends on how you look at it. It can lead to a kind of despair. And I think the despair is quite real too. And it kind of hangs around in the background. Now, I've been reading for the last few years what I would consider some voices who are contributing to a new cosmology. They're saying, all right, now I happen to be a big fan of the ancient myths and stories, and I think they still have a lot to tell us about cosmology in general, and kind of the mythic, philosophical, and poetic backdrop of human insight into the way the world works. However, they're saying the new cosmology is essentially the story of evolution. These are people like Brian Swim and Matthew Fox and Joanna Macy and Thomas Berry. Maybe you've heard of these authors. You should check them out. And a lot of what I'm going to say actually comes from some things that Matthew Fox has written a bit about, and Thomas Berry for that matter. And they're saying, all right, so the old cosmologies don't work because they don't have scientific language. They were never intended to. That's one of the great mistakes that Christianity has made around the Bible. They've tried to play the scientific game with a book that's not intended to do that. What's a modern example? Have you ever seen Van Gogh's sunflower paintings, which was vandalized recently? I have, and it shocked me. Like, I'm often not moved by visual art in that way, but I was when I saw it in London one time. It just absolutely leveled me. But if I read a Wikipedia article about sunflowers, it just doesn't do the same thing, you know? And that's a little bit like the Bible. The Bible's more like the painting, and the Wikipedia entry is what we might call science. So anyway, that's my, here, I don't know if that helps you or not. What was my point? The reimagination of cosmology must involve human evolution and evolution more generally, and things like quarks and weirdness. The new cosmology must. And in a way, if we can learn to relate to it in a deeper and more conscious way, it might lead to a more conscious and life-giving way of being in the world. That's the argument of Thomas Berry and others. So listen to what Thomas Berry says. We will recover our sense of wonder. So he, in part, is saying we've lost it. Ancient people had a sense of wonder, as far as we know. We will recover our sense of wonder and our sense of the sacred only if we appreciate the universe beyond ourselves as a revelatory experience of that numinous presence whence all things come into being. Did you see how that's kind of like a theological statement, but it's not quite? He's not exactly saying God, but he's saying, all right, just the universe as it is, as a kind of revelation, as a kind of numinous presence. He goes on, indeed, the universe is the primary sacred reality. like atoms and electrons and neutrons and all the other things that I forgot I was supposed to remember from the ninth grade. We become sacred. We become sacred, he says, by our participation in this more sublime dimension of the world about us. I'm suggesting that Thomas Berry and Bertrand Russell, there's a little bit of tension here. One is more situated in what we would call despair, and Thomas Berry is saying it doesn't have to be that way. Perhaps there can be a kind of sacred participation as we deepen into the conversation with the way the world actually is, otherwise known as the universe, otherwise known as science. Well, science is not the same thing as the universe, but it's supposed to be pointing toward it. Okay, these two quotations are just laying some background here. Okay, where do I want to start with my notes? Here's a question you could ask yourself. What do you think? Is the universe friendly or not? Are we just a collision and a collection of atoms, and that's it? And everything that we call valuable is just some kind of artificial fiction, a kind of construct, you could say. Okay. Let's pick on Newton, because it's always fun to look back and pick on dead people. Okay. So the Newtonian Revolution gave us a vision of the universe that is mechanistic. All right? It's a machine. And in fact, the technical way of putting it would be that it's an unchanging constant. That's what Newtonian worldview. It's an unchanging constant. And it does actually seem that way. I mean, just like if you're just walking around, like what would be an example of that? The sun comes up every day and then goes down. All right. For the most part, you could say, oh, I know there's some weird things going on in the universe and everything, but mostly it's an unchanging constant. Wouldn't you agree? It feels that way. And most of us are still very influenced by the kind of this Newtonian vision and machine-like vision. You can hear it creep into the way people talk about the planet or the world or the universe. It's like a clock, you know? It runs. It just does its thing, and it's unchanging, and it just goes on and on and on like this. This influenced people's ideas around God, because they say, if that's the case, so sort of the theological response to post-Newton was, okay, the universe is a machine, we agree with you, God made it, you know? Maybe you've heard the old argument, like they find a clock on the beach, and, you know, couldn't you have just randomly formed that way? Someone must have made the clock. Very simple argument. But they're not arguing with the vision of the universe, that it's an unchanging constant, and there it is going along, and maybe if you're religious, God every once in a while gets bored, and he's like, you know, I think I'll intervene. And we call those supernatural events. Now, why this thing and not that thing? You know, well, that creates its own kind of problems. But basically, it runs as it should according to fixed laws and is unchanging. Are you with me so far? Okay. The problem with post-Newtonian vision of science is that it's not true. That's the main problem with it. And once we started going deeper into math and into science and so forth, it became a lot more complex. And the way in which the universe came to be, and even what we would consider the laws of nature, don't always obey the very rules that we thought were set up in the first place. So you could just say we haven't gotten to the rules yet, and I would agree, and maybe we haven't. But that kind of vision has collapsed to a certain extent. And in a way, evolution, instead of an unchanging constant, evolution brings with it the idea of things change. And they move from simple to complex. You know, that's true of, you know, biological evolution. Not only do you have to ask why is there something rather than nothing, I mean, if you want to ask that, you also have to acknowledge things move from simple to complex. You're a more complex being than an amoeba. Not by a whole lot, but by a little bit, okay? More complex. And why is that the case? We don't exactly know. That's the why is not so much what science is interested in asking always. So, all right. So, now I want to have some fun. I want to give you some facts about the world. So this is fun with science. Fun with science, even though My area of expertise is really mythology and biblical studies in Hebrew. We'll have fun with science anyway. All right. I'd like to say what we're discovering now, the new scientific imagination, is changing the way we view the world, and I think changing questions around responsibility and consciousness in general. So, okay, here are some fun facts, party facts. New stars are being born every 15 seconds, and they're dying about the same rate. So just think about that. A new star every 15 seconds or so is born, and about every 15 seconds, a new star dies. When I say star, I mean the sun, things like the sun. Like, that is a wild, imaginative, and weird universe. If the sun dies, it's over for us, correct? But every 15 seconds, one is dying. So what is the universe like? Is it an unchanging constant? Maybe, but in as much as it's kind of in this repetitive death and life cycle. It's dying and being reborn. And you're like that too. It's like there's a medieval idea that the internal workings of the psyche, they wouldn't have used that word, but I'm paraphrasing, is the same as the cosmos. All right. If you've ever had your chart read, that'll freak you out. All right. So the internal workings of your psyche is the same thing as the cosmos. The internal is a reflection of the external. There's this dialogue going on, and you're going to die. I hate to tell you that, but you're going to die. I'm going to die. We're just like the sun the suns of the universe every 15 seconds. And strangely enough, you consist of particles that predate you. You know, that doesn't even make any sense. I can tell you that. That makes no freaking sense at all to me. And you're going to be recycled. Like, you want to live forever? You got it. It's really going to happen. I mean, until the universe finally, I don't know if we're on the in-breath or the out-breath. Maybe there's a kind of overness to it in another 14.5 billion years. I don't know. But for the most part, you're going to live forever. You'll be reincarnated. Now, whether or not you'll be conscious of that or you'll be up in heaven playing soccer with Jesus, I have no idea. But that's a weird thing. Even if you think about religion or religions or spirituality intuiting these things and then come to find out, yeah, that seems to be the case. All right, so that's just something on stars here. Okay, so here are a few things on the solar system, our solar system. And our solar system is part of a galaxy, right? The galaxy is the Milky Way. Have you seen the Milky Way? If you haven't seen it recently, it's still around. It's hard to see. I saw it a couple times this summer. You should make it an effort. You should make an effort once a year to see the Milky Way. It's this river of stars, and it's just magnificent. We're just far enough away from the density of that life can exist, and life as we know it can exist, human life, conscious life, the kind of consciousness that we have. So anyway, but we're just one of billions of galaxies. So if we shrink down the galaxy of the Milky Way into the size of a pea, and then we put it in a stadium with other galaxies, we could fill the stadium up with little peas, you know. So the universe seems big, in other words, seems big. And there we are in our solar system. And the funny thing about our solar system is that that we're midway, okay, we've reached midlife. We're midway. And so about 4.5 billion years ago, we started the in-breath. We're about midway, and about 5 billion years, maybe 6 billion years, the sun will devour the earth with its gaseous, voracious appetite, all right? And it's over. It's over. Earth is over. Now, that's kind of a long time. Don't freak out. It's not next week. But that we're midway. That's an unusual observation. We're midway in the life-death life cycle of our particular star. And midway turns out to be a lot more interesting the deeper you look at it. Okay, what else is true about midway? Okay, the universe is expanding. You know, raise your hand if you knew the universe is expanding. All right, it's accelerating a little bit, as far as we know. And what's amazing right now, midway, we can see through math, so see in quotation marks, we can see the edges. We can imagine seeing imaginatively with our math the edges of the universe. We know its breadth. We think we know its breadth. And we can see pretty far with our telescopes, as the new telescope is proven. But because of the accelerated pace, it won't be long before our ancestors will be unable to view the universe as it is. It'll be too far gone. Doesn't matter how powerful, how advanced we are from technology, it will be out of view and it won't exist to them. They won't know it existed. They might look back at our text and say, they said it existed, but you know, I've seen the pyramids and read Akkadian and ancient the proto-Hebrew script, and I read things in there, and I don't think they definitely knew what they were talking about. I think, well, they did and they didn't. Who knows? Our ancestors might think that we're full of crap, but we're not full of crap. We can just see because we're midway in this expansion. Soon it's going to accelerate beyond our capacity to see the edges of the universe. That's weird, all right? I don't know what you do with that. You can't exactly put that on Facebook. I don't even, that would take forever to type, for one thing. I don't know. But it's strange. So here's a passage from a book called The View from the Center of the Universe by Primack and Abrams. So the midway point of cosmic time is late enough that intelligent beings have evolved who have instruments to observe the distant galaxies, but not so late that the galaxies have begun to disappear. Without this period of overlap, it might have been impossible for intelligent beings ever to get the chance to figure out the nature of the universe. Lucky, you would wonder. Random collection of particles. Okay, this later gets called the Goldilocks principle. I don't know if you've heard about this, but I'm going to read you some things about the Goldilocks principle. All right. It's like what I mean by it's not too hot, not too cold. We're late enough where we discovered things, but we're not too late where we can't discover them. So the Goldilocks principle seems to be quite all over the place. Here's another example of it. Okay, so we're midway between the size of, human beings are midway between the size of a cell and the size of the Earth. Okay? It's related to the same midway point stuff. You're halfway, okay? So, size of a cell, size of the Earth, you're right in the middle. Also, a single atom in one cell, a single atom in one cell, is as tiny as I am to the sun. Okay, these are all Goldilocks principle ideas, midway. So, you might not agree that the universe is friendly, but you at least you have to say, it's kind of weird, all right? And the weirdness of things makes it possible that we're conscious to even reflect upon the weirdness of things. Otherwise, it wouldn't happen. Here's another example. So creatures much smaller than we, now I'm reading, creatures much smaller than we could not have sufficient complexity for our kind of intelligence. Okay, creatures smaller. Because they would not be made of a large enough number of atoms. So in order to have the intelligence that we have to ask questions like, is the universe friendly, we have to be the right size. Not too hot, not too cold. All right, this is the Goldilocks thing. But intelligent creatures could not be much larger than we either, because the speed of nerve impulses and ultimately the speed of light. So the way things travel inside our brains, we're just the right size to reflect. So if we were any bigger, like the dinosaurs, for example, it's not going to happen. There's too much distance. You think the speed of light is fast, but it's only fast from a human point of view. It's not that fast in the global sense, in the universe sense. If you were going somewhere at the speed of light, it would still take a ridiculously long time to get anywhere. Well, that also applies in the nerves. So we're limited by the... you're looking at me like, what the hell is going on? I don't know. I'm just telling you fun facts. Okay, I don't want to give you too many more because we could just go on and on. What kind of questions does this relate to? Well, it relates to questions of, well, what responsibility do we have with the kind of consciousness that we're granted to be midway between things, to have evolved to this place to ask reflexive questions around what is what is purpose? And how is it that we got here? And what does it mean to cooperate or not cooperate? These are the questions, of the new cosmology. It's no longer a choice of I'm going to believe in old religious things or I'm going to believe in science. I don't think it works quite that way. I think we need much more emphasis on, I don't want to say scientific materialism, but let's call it the emerging fields of science. And we also have to ask questions of how then do we want to live? And that's had been, at least, largely the case of the religious domain. I'm saying these two things need to come closer together, at least in my view. So, part of the reason why I wanted to give you these just kind of strange facts about the universe is because I'm wondering something like, where does wonder, awe, or purpose fit into these things? It's ultimately a question of how shall we live? So, is the universe friendly? Here's my answer to the question. It's friendly enough that we're able to ask such a question. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. It's friendly enough that human consciousness has evolved to reflect upon the world. And if there's no consciousness, does it exist? That's a philosophical question anyway. You say, of course it exists. Well, how would you know if there's nothing to become conscious of the way things are? So it is a kind of strange and mysterious gift. And at least the domain of religion has tried to say the gift of consciousness comes with responsibility. And I want to ask the same kind of question. The gift of the latest information about the way the world works, we ought to be asking questions about what is our responsibility. Do we have some responsibility? Do you want to continue to cooperate with the way things are to make the world, I don't know, fill in the blank, more beautiful or good or true or meaningful or cooperative or I don't know. You could say those are all social constructs and they don't mean anything. I'm still saying it forces us to ask the kind of question. So I guess I want to end with Mary Oliver's little line. She says, I don't know exactly what a prayer is. Right? I don't know exactly what a prayer is. And that's the way I feel, honestly. That's the way I feel about prayer. In a way, I feel like, I guess because of some of my religious hang-ups from the past, the word prayer makes me uncomfortable. Like, if you were to ask me to pray in public, I would, like, have kind of a mental breakdown. Don't do it. I just freak out a little bit. And that's most of that's just my own immaturity and, you know, my hang-ups and things like that. But I get what Mary Oliver's getting at. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. But she says, but I do know how to kneel. And that's what I'm asking here about, is the universe friendly? It's friendly enough, and how shall we live? It's something like kneeling, at least in my view. It's something like kneeling. It's something like kneeling. And that might not look like for you before some deity in the clouds, but even the smallest of things that we're coming to discover about the way the world is makes you and I not the center of the universe on one level and also an essential center of the universe. We're midway in size to become conscious of ourselves. So I think maybe that's enough said. I don't know exactly what a prayer is, but I do know how to kneel. I would like to learn how to kneel. That's maybe what I would say. Thanks for listening.